And so when the time of harvest came, he expected, of course, to receive his share of the crop. And he sent his servants, one after another, for it. And they beat one and murdered another and so on, till he finally sent his son, saying, "Surely they'll reverence my son." And it said the husbandmen, the people who were in charge of his vineyard, said, "Ah, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and then we'll take the inheritance." Now it shows, they themselves, these husbandmen in charge of the vineyard, they couldn't be of any tribe of Israel. Because all of Israel were told repeatedly, Isaiah says it half a dozen times fully, "Thou art my servant, O Israel." And these were not God's servants. And they were not his children. If they had been his children, they would have been the heirs. But they said of the one coming, "This is the heir. Let's kill him, and then we'll take the inheritance." And, of course, it was prophetic of the way they treated him. And you notice that in every one of these three reports of that parable, it concludes with the statement that the priests and Pharisees were ready to grab him and murder him on account of this, because they understood that he spoke this parable concerning them. They didn't miss the point. The children of Satan know who they are and what they're doing, and they're only afraid that we'll find out who they are and what they're doing, and we'll upset their little game. Well, by way of noting where we are in the book of Revelation, the next thing we come to, we've completed chapter 14 and start on chapter 15. "And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is completed the wrath of God. And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire. And them that had gotten the victory over the beast and over his image and over his mark and over the number of his name stand on the sea of glass, having the harps of God." Now you'll find a more correct translation doesn't say they stand on this sea of glass. It says they stand beside it. Now, what would be a sea of glass mingled with fire? Probably some of you know that one of the products of a volcano is volcanic glass, obsidian, usually black in color. And a sea of glass mingled with fire would be a pretty good description of a great lava flow. So, the judgments coming upon the earth might well be likened to a lava flow. And these who had gotten the victory over the beast were standing beside, not on, this lava flow. They were not harmed by it. "And they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, Great and marvelous are thy works, Yahweh God Almighty. Just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Who shall not fear thee, O Yahweh, and glorify thy name? For thou art holy. For all nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy judgments are made manifest." So definitely, we are at the edge of a final period of God's judgments. You remember there were the seven seals that were opened, each revealing a different stage of the judgment. The opening of the seventh seal was again subdivided into the blowing of seven trumpets. And the seventh trumpet having sounded, you come to a subdivision again into the seven last plagues. Now, nothing short of the great judgments of God are going to get the people who have control of the world today out of their positions of power. Not only are the great bulk of the people entirely helpless to do anything about it, but the great bulk of the people have been so brainwashed that they don't even want to do anything about it. So it's the judgments of God. Now, all this perfectly consistent, this is what the Bible has been talking about from the beginning. Isaiah 26, verse 9. With my soul have I desired thee in the night. Yea, with my spirit within me will I seek thee early. For when thy judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness. Again, Ezekiel 39, verse 21, quoting the words of God himself. And I will set my glory among the heathen, and all the heathen shall see my judgment that I have executed, and my hand that I have laid upon them. Now there can be no crime without a criminal, no wickedness without some wicked person to see that it's done. And that is why merely putting band-aids on the wound afterward hasn't gotten anywhere. We've not been eliminating the source. But this judgment is one that's going to remove the cause of all this. These Edomite Jews. Isaiah 34, verse 5. Again, quoting the words of God. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Edom, upon the people of my curse, to judgment. Now you remember the book of Malachi, last book of the Old Testament, speaking of these Edomites, says that they are the people against whom Yahweh has indignation forever. So, they are the people of God's curse. Again, Isaiah 28, verses 14 to 20, which describes the present world situation exactly. Wherefore, hear ye the word of Yahweh, ye scornful men that rule this people which is in Jerusalem. Because ye have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with hell we are at agreement. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us. For we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. Judgment also will I lay to the lion, and righteousness to the plummet. And the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the hiding place. And your covenant with death shall be annulled, and your agreement with hell shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then ye shall be trodden down by it. From the time that it goeth forth, it shall take you. For morning by morning shall it pass over, by day and by night. And it shall be a vexation only to understand the report. For the bed is shorter than that a man can stretch himself on it, and the covering narrower than that he can wrap himself in it. Now let's look this thing over. Those in charge of this people which is in Jerusalem, they were these Edomite Jews at the time Isaiah wrote, and they're a mixture of Edomite and Khazar Jews today. We have made a covenant with death, and with hell we are at agreement. We have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. Yes. They said 6 million Jews were killed by Hitler. Well, 1 million of them are in Palestine today, and the other 5 million are in the United States. The Jews' own statistics showed that when Hitler came to power in 1933, there were only 500,000 Jews in Germany. Now, he would have had to kill the 500,000 and then resurrect them, then kill them again and resurrect them again, 10 times in all. And if he could perform miracles like that, he was a man that we should have had some respect for. What actually happened, of course, was that over the period between 1933 and 39, the great bulk of them moved out, including the great bulk of the Jews who were anywhere in Europe. It was a matter of a well-known scandal at the time that the ships we were sending in such a parade across the Atlantic, carrying supplies to England and France, were coming back, loaded almost to the point they were swamped with Jews, who were admitted to this country illegally. But remember, Franklin Roosevelt had Jewish blood in him, and he was completely the tool of the Jews, and he was conniving at it. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, that is, the great Russian communist invasion, it will not come over us, they say, because the Jews are the absolute masters of communist Russia, and all the nations behind the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe. The only squabble that exists between Russia and China today is not that one is more or less communist than the other, but communism in China is carried on by Chinese communists and directed by them, and communism in Russia is the work of Jewish communists, and there's a squabble for power between them. But, God says, for you think you can control all this, you're not going to. The hail, the rain of bombs falling from the sky, shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the hiding place. Now, I pointed out to you before that wherever the Bible uses the term waters symbolically, it is always a symbol for great masses of people. The people of the world in general, often spoken of as the sea. A people in motion, a great invading army, is often spoken of as an overflowing river. So here, when the Russian invasion comes, it will overflow them. Now, when we studied the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel, we saw that it pointed out Russia's strategy, a two-pronged attack, the major one being by air across the pole and down our west coast from the eastern shores of Siberia to attack the United States. But at the same time, the other prong of the pincher would come down, not straight south down through Turkey. The Turks are tough fighters, and Russia couldn't get through without months or years of fighting. Secondly, she'd have to cross range after range of mountains that are too rugged for mechanized forces to get through. She will bypass Russia, Turkey, I should say, east of Turkey. She'd come right down through Iraq, seizing the great oil fields as she goes, then turn west across the desert plains country, coming into Syria from the east and southerly, from Syria down into Palestine, down to take Suez and beachhead into Africa. And there's no way to stop that flood coming through, overflowing the very place where the Jews have said, we now hold the strategic center of the world. The ordinary Russian knows who his oppressors are. He doesn't dare say so because the so-called anti-Semitism is punished by death in Russia. It's a virtue to be anti-American or anti-British or anti-German. In fact, it's a compulsory virtue, but a death penalty for being anti-Jewish. It's a compulsory virtue to be anti-Christian or anti-Buddhist or anti-Mohammedan, but the death penalty for being anti-Jewish. Now you put this great Russian army on the march. You get them involved in battle, and these Russians are going to say, well, if we have to do all the fighting and all the dying, we might as well do some of the stealing as well. And as they go through Palestine, they are going to loot it of everything worth stealing, just as they did when they went through Czechoslovakia and East Germany and that sort of thing. So, that is one phase of this great judgment that is coming upon the whole world. Revelation 15, verses 5 to 8, shows that this process is now ready to get underway. And after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. And the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles. And one of the four living creatures gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. Now you can see that the only thing remaining ahead now is to trace what each of these seven last plagues were. And that's too big a subject to get started on tonight.
The smoke
of the glory of God.
Yeah.
Well, the Bible speaks of that in other places. The tabernacle in the wilderness, the original tent tabernacle during the march of the Exodus. When the presence of God came into it, it was filled with vapor. On the dedication of Solomon's temple, when God accepted the dedication of it and his presence was manifest there, again, it was filled with vapor. The glory of God is a tremendous concentration of electrical energy. After all, he is the originator and source of all energy, and basically, it is electrical in its nature. You remember Moses saw a bush burning and yet not consumed by the flames, and he went over to see what it was. And God spoke to him out of this burning bush. Well, people who like to consider themselves scientifically educated like to scoff at that and say, whoever heard of fire that doesn't burn? Well, now, for several hundred years past, anybody who was a sailor on one of the old tall-masted sailing ships could tell you about it, because he'd seen it many times. St. Elmo's fire.
Yeah.
When there was a thundercloud overhead, and that tremendous electrical potential was getting ready to jump that gap in lightning. Here, from the tops of the mast, you had streamers of electrical fire discharging. And the sailors noted that when you got that, the ship never was struck by lightning, because the terrific charge built up there was discharged before you got the great smashing discharge of lightning. Anybody who's done much mountain climbing knows that sometimes he's been up on a high peak when a thunderstorm came up and he's had to get down to lower levels hastily because the very rocks around him would begin to sputter and crackle. It was getting to the point where the electrical potential was almost at the point of jumping the gap as a lightning discharge. If you look it up in any scientific textbook or even a good encyclopedia article, Collier's Encyclopedia, for example, under St. Elmo's Fire, mentions the fact that these discharges, electrical corona discharges of a blue-violet streamer-like flames, has been known to cover as much as an acre in area at one time. So here, with all the terrific concentration of electrical energy which the presence of God would bring, here it was. It wasn't an oxidizing flame. It didn't burn the bush.
Yeah, the same thing when he descended on Mount Sinai.
Yeah. Now, a characteristic of that, often noted, is that if there's much humidity, the moisture in the air is often condensed into fog by it. So that you would have the same thing indicated there, where the presence of God is with this enormous electrical charge, why, it would fog up the atmosphere. And anybody would go into it, of course, at his peril.